we have a single matter for argument this morning at 10:30. Apparently, we have been informed that the roof in the courtroom is, shall we say, leaking. Our apologies to the parties and counsel. That was not intentional, to try and get y'all to speed up your arguments, although it would be creative. Anyway, we're here to hear a single case. The panel that will be here today consists of, to my left, Justice Mike Wallach, to my right, Justice Dana Womack, and I am Justice Wade Birdwell. And if the clerk will go ahead and call the case and identify counsel for us, please.
We now call Service Corporation International Gregory W. Spencer Funeral Directors and Dignity Moral Network Incorporated versus Tamika Williams Burdo. May it please the clerk, Mr. Alan Wright will argue for the appellant. Ms. Allie Crocker Russell will argue for the appellee.
Counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This appeal concerns the enforcement of an arbitration agreement in a funeral services case, a funeral services contract. The appellant, the single appellant, is Gregory Spencer Funeral Directors. In case it's not clear from the record, the other two defendants in the trial court were not movements on the motion to compel arbitration and are not, therefore, appellants in this appeal. The appeal focuses on the evidentiary and legal framework under which we determine arbitrability, and as the court is aware, the burdens of the parties, the party seeking to compel arbitration initially bears the burden to show that there's the existence of a valid and enforceable arbitration agreement. Once that showing is made, then the party opposing arbitration has the burden to prove its any defenses it has to the arbitration provision. In terms of contract interpretation principles, because arbitration is a creature of contract, arbitration agreements are construed according to state law contract principles. And that's important in this case because one of the fundamental principles of contract construction that applies in the arbitration context is that the court must consider the entire contract between the parties and not isolated provisions in that contract, and if necessary to harmonize and construe those provisions, examining all the terms of the parties' agreement. In addition, of course, the law is well settled. This is an FAA arbitration case, but it's well settled under federal and state law that there's a heavy presumption in favor of arbitration. Arbitration provisions are favored. And that comes into play several different ways in this case.
Doesn't the presumption just apply once you establish the existence of an arbitration agreement?
Actually, no, Your Honor. It applies even in the construction to determine whether there's a valid arbitration agreement. We've cited cases in our brief that talk about the issue of vagueness because that's an issue that has come up in this case. And there are cases holding, and we cited them in our brief, that hold that if a provision is vague, that could actually weigh in favor of finding arbitration. So a vague provision does not preclude enforcement. What I'm trying to say is that the presumption in favor of arbitration.
That's a question of scope. You have to have an agreement first before you have scope, don't you?
I think a scope is certainly part of it. Is, you know, what claims are covered by the agreement? What did the parties agree to? So in that sense, yes, it's scope, and I'm not sure I'm parsing that very well. To your point, if I understand the question correctly, did the parties enter into an agreement? That's going to be construed, you know, under traditional contract principles. I don't think there's necessarily a presumption there that would be unique to
that
arbitration.
Was my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in this case, the issue that arose is with the order that the trial court entered, and in particular, there were two motions to compel arbitration, and we've addressed this in some detail in our briefs, but I think it's helpful to lay it out briefly again. The initial motion to compel arbitration that Spencer filed was incomplete. And we say that now with the benefit of hindsight.
So so the original motion to compel, what you were arguing, there was in fact an arbitration agreement, and you were arguing what the scope, that the claims that had been made were within the scope of that arbitration agreement. There was at least some mention within the incomplete agreement that was attached of arbitration. Did your motion, or did you in argument during the hearing, make any argument referencing the other aspects of the arbitration agreement that were provided subsequently as an attachment to the first amended motion?
There was only one hearing. At the hearing, there was discussion because of a deposition that had been taken about terms that were testified to by a witness to have existed, but that were not before the court. Now, those terms.
Is there some reason why you didn't pull down the motion and say we need to confirm what's going on here? Because basically what we're dealing with an order that is post-hearing. It's an order on the original motion. It's also an order on a post-hearing motion to strike that nobody heard any argument. The trial court didn't hear any argument on. So we've got temporal aspects and procedural aspects of this that are overlapping that the record's a mess with, okay? And it's a mess because of both parties, okay? But the initial mess is we don't have the complete agreement. So are we supposed to be looking at the denial of the motion to compel based upon the actual matter that was in front of the court at the time of the hearing, or are we supposed to take into account everything that happened after the fact? Or are we just basically saying there's no real error in denying the original motion because it was incomplete and therefore you didn't meet your burden? But it was error for her to deny the opportunity after the fact with the first amended to have a hearing with regard to that. So what is your real complaint here? You did not get a motion to compel granted, or that you were not heard on the actual motion to compel that set forth the necessary requirements?
It's actually,
and that's a loaded question.
Yeah, well, I want to make sure that I am responsive. I think it's all of that, and I'll try to explain because I want to be helpful. I don't say that lightly. The initial motion that the court heard, you've seen the record where the judge says this is incomplete, this is vague, and there were actually, after the deposition, a more robust due diligence process ensued to locate those pages, and they were ultimately located, but not until after the hearing. But to your question on, in terms,
were those actually the pages of the agreement itself, the underlying agreement, or were those pages of a form that were then inserted into the signature pages that you had attached to the original motion?
Mr. Lynch of SCI testified that that was form language, but that was provided with every contract that they entered into. So it was uniform boilerplate language, and that was provided to Ms. Williams in this case.
Well, the court asked for additional briefing. How does submitting additional documents constitute additional briefing?
Well, we did provide a brief also that addressed all of these issues. But I think this ties in with Justice Birdwell's question about what are we complaining about. We believe that the court committed error by ruling on the initial motion to compel because it was superseded by the amended motion to compel.
In what universe does a motion that's already been heard get superseded by a post-hearing amendment?
Well,
where is your authority, procedural authority, for that?
The authority,
whether it's summary judgment or not, any authority that allows an amendment of a motion that's already been heard by the court after the fact, and then, because basically that's getting to say ali ali oxen free, and oh, by the way, don't actually rule on what we asked you to rule on at the hearing. We want you to rule on something else that you didn't have before you at that time. You don't have any authority for that.
Well, the authority.
So explain to me how we're supposed to reverse her on that basis.
Well, our position is that without the burdens that fall on the movement to present a complete agreement, if there's no bar, for example, under, as counsel referred to, under Rule Civil Procedure 63 or Civil Practice and Remedies Code Chapter 170.023, that we were attempting to be responsive to the concerns that the judge had voiced at the hearing. She said, this is incomplete, this is vague. So we went back and we did the due diligence and we found the pages and we produced them to opposing counsel in discovery. We did file the amended motion along with our brief, and then we set it for a hearing, of course, conferring with the clerk of the court and observing all of those formalities in order to make sure that everyone had an opportunity to be heard and to respond. And I think our position is that there was no bar to under Rule 63 or under any Rule 166 pretrial order to prevent the filing of that amended motion. Now, to your
if there's a question as to the existence of an arbitration agreement, doesn't the case law say that the court is required to summarily rule on that? And wouldn't that invoke in essence, the rules of summary judgments? Wouldn't that be the analogy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the court made clear at the initial hearing that what was being seen was not perceived by the court to be the complete document. And the court went out of its way, in my view, to say, I'm reserving a ruling. I'm not ruling on this. You guys get your act together, for lack of a better term, and that's what we did. That's what we attempted to do with the amended motion.
Did the court ask for additional evidence, or did the court ask for additional briefing?
The court did not ask for additional evidence.
And do you recognize a difference between submission of additional evidence and briefing?
I recognize the difference, but I don't think it's material in this setting.
Well, if it's, how can it not be material if you're saying that the first submission of evidence was incomplete and you're adding to it, and that it's what you're adding to it is what you're relying upon to ask the court to change its position or to rely upon to make a decision? How is that not material?
Well, material perhaps is not the best word, but it's not. I'm not saying it's not material because we believe the evidence is material, but the fact of the filing, I don't think a second filing was. I can't point you to a rule that says that's barred. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Well, there's a general principle that we can only reverse a court on a matter that was actually submitted to it. Okay, so the actual part of the order here with regard to denying the motion to compel, right? We know that the original motion to compel was in fact submitted. We know what evidence it was submitted on. We've got a hearing transcript with regard to that. And we have a reservation by the court on the record, but only with regard to matters of briefing with regard to vagueness and things of that nature. There's no leave granted in that hearing transcript with regard to the addition of any evidence one way or the other. Okay? So the portion of the court's order that we're being asked to reverse and to turn around, and you're not just asking for us to reverse on that, you're asking for us to compel arbitration, all right? What's before her is what's before us with regard to that. And if the evidence is incomplete, the evidence is incomplete with regard to that. Whether or not she correctly then shut down the ability to file a motion of an amended motion with a complete contract and was not, you know, was permitted to do that under the rules. Are you aware of any authority that says it's that a motion to compel arbitration is a one-time thing? You either win it on the original motion or you don't?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. And I think I finally absorb your point. The denial of the original motion, I'm thinking of it in terms of a potential appellate remedy, and you mentioned that. If it was not error to deny the original motion on the incomplete submission, then perhaps this court goes to the next step, which you just mentioned, which is not a one-time only issue with a motion to compel arbitration, and maybe that switches from a rendition issue to a remand issue, that if it was error, we believe it was error to deny, regardless of the ruling on the original motion, we believe it was error to grant the motion to strike and deny the amended motion and deny that additional evidence. And perhaps the remedy for that is best seen as remand to the trial court.
I mean, technically, you didn't ask, but you filed an amended motion with attached evidence in support of the amended motion. There's nothing in that amended motion that refers the court back saying we are asking for leave for you to consider this new evidence with regard to the original motion.
That's correct.
And then you have an objection after the fact that no, you shouldn't be able to do that, but that wasn't heard either. So you've got some time to answer this, but that's it.
Well, I'm seeing the analytical framework a little more clearly now, and I think the court ruled the court denied the original motion. That ruling seems to me clear enough. Then what is the next step in the arbitration context? I think a party is entitled to bring another motion if they have additional evidence, and they're entitled to be heard on that, and that's what we were denied, and perhaps that should be considered as a completely separate issue from the original motion. It would be the amended motion and the evidence that the court is obliged to consider, that we are obliged as the movement seeking arbitration to bring forward, and that we believe, entitled to a ruling on that we didn't get.
Okay. Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Would you add about a minute, please?
May it please the court, your honors, counsel. My name is Allie Crocker Russell, and I represent the appellee in this matter, Ms. Tanika Williams-Berdeau. And today I'm asking the court to affirm the trial court's decision in ordering the denial of the appellant's motion to compel arbitration and affirm the order denying the first amended motion to arbitrate and order striking the appellate's Exhibit 1. And I think it's important to briefly speak about the procedural history in this case. The first motion to arbitrate and abate was entered with the parties that's not contested around November 9th, 2018. Now, after the underlying cause of action would be the mishandling of the appellee's husband's corpse. And so after some difficulties with the funeral arrangements and the handling of his corpse, there were some negotiations between the parties, which we saw in Ms. Lauren Downs' deposition taken on March 30th, 2022, which was a day before the hearing on the first motion to compel arbitration. During Ms. Downs' testimony, she testified that she believed once shown the contract, the November 9th, 2018 contract as an exhibit, that contract was either mutually rescinded or renegotiated to include that Ms. Williams Berdeau was to only pay for the merchandise directly given from the defendant in that matter. And when asked if they could produce that contract, she said they should be able to produce that contract. There was some further testimony from her after some questioning about what that meant as far as a new contractual agreement, and she said that it was rescinded and didn't believe that Ms. Williams-Berdeau was ever given the opportunity to sign. After the March 31st, 2022 hearing, and upon advising the trial court judge of the recent deposition testimony, she gave the appellee an opportunity to supplement and brief vagueness as well as provide deposition testimony that would allude that the November 9th, 2018 contract was not a valid contract or the most current contract before the court's consideration.
So it's your understanding that Judge Fitzpatrick actually granted leave to supplement the evidentiary record?
Only limited, and both appellant and appellee supplemented or stated in their briefs, and to quote quickly the trial court judge, I'm going to reserve. You guys have 2 weeks to get the deposition transcribed and get me something showing that she said it was rescinded and that there's no contract currently. And if you want to provide some sort of briefing on the issue of vagueness on the arbitration clause, I will look at that. Both parties briefed those direct quotes from the trial court judge. I believe the trial court transcript is in the record as well. It's my understanding that there was only leave to supplement the deposition transcript of Ms. Downs and Ms. Webster, that it happened before, I believe the day before the hearing, as well as brief vagueness. And to clarify from what appellant...
If it had done the day before the hearing, then why is she granting leave to supplement the deposition transcript?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. It appeared once she came in, and I believe the trial transcript showed, she was worried about this vague, or if it was vague enough. She wanted some sort of case law that showed merely mentioning the term arbitration without any other terms and conditions was enforceable. When asked appellate counsel if she knew...
Because quite literally the only thing before the court at that point in time was a signature page that mentions arbitration.
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Quite literally there was no venue for arbitration, no means of who appointed the arbitrator, nothing. It was just, it literally says the party shall... attend arbitration.
Okay.
And as this court's aware that I'm sorry.
To get their testimony straight, though, there was evidence before the court, which the court could have relied upon, that the agreement was rescinded.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the agreement that was attached to the motion.
Yes.
So taking away all the other circumstances, and looking at it from an abuse of discretion standpoint, the court had evidence which, if it chose to believe, could have denied arbitration based upon a rescission of the agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. And she mentioned that in the trial's transcript as well. And so when the appellees submitted their underlying brief of vagueness, they also had the opportunity to supplement and brief out rescission.
But there was there also not at least affidavit testimony proving up the incomplete contract and that it had been signed, that it was her signature, et cetera? So basically, don't we have a fact issue as to whether there was, in fact, an agreement?
Well, my argument to that I presented in my brief is that essentially the defendants in this matter have impeached themselves multiple times. The first contract that they proposed, which was the November 9th, 2018 contract, they provided an affidavit from Ms. Webster stating that this two-page contract was true and correct. Then once they went and miraculously found another page 3 and 4, they provided impeachment testimony saying that she actually signed pages 1, 2, 3, and 4. But if you look at pages 3 and 4, there are discrepancies in that contractual agreement. If you look at 1, 2, 3, and 4 combined, there are three separate arbitration agreements that the appellant has conveniently ignored. And in my brief, I brought up there is a completely separate arbitration clause in page 4. So they're trying to enforce in their first amended motion to arbitrate the arbitration clause under 3. But you have two separate pages that compete on page 3 and 4. And page 4 is four completely separate companies making everlasting memories.
But on what authority does the trial court make a credibility determination to deny the arbitration? Because the arbitration provision, there is one there with a signature that's not undenied, okay? But even on what basis does she deny it outright, other than saying, well, there's a fact issue here as to whether or not there's an agreement, what constitutes the agreement, and whether or not there's an arbitration provision in the agreement? So I can understand her denying the original motion, but on what basis does she strike the first amended motion at that point in time? And are you arguing that you don't ever have to go to arbitration ever again because they had their one shot? Just like I asked him, where's the authority that arbitration is a one shot. You either get it right the first time, or you have to try the case in court.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any law that says you get one shot at arbitration, but I believe the facts of this case tend to put forth in my argument of what the trustworthiness and credibility of the second contract was.
What authority does a trial court have to determine contractual terms with regard to an arbitration clause if there is a fact issue with regard to credibility? Credibility issues are normally left for juries, but and I'm asking that because I do not know the answer to that.
I'm not sure on that point, Your Honor. I just know that typically when you're talking about an abuse of discretion, that the court typically defers to the trial court for matters of factual details of the underlying case.
I mean, I can see where she could say you just haven't made your case at this point in time. But then she forecloses the ability to make that case based upon additional evidence in the First Amendment without any hearing on your objections with regard to that. So that procedurally, that's what I'm trying to deal with. They're asking us to look at everything and say she was completely wrong. You're asking us to look at everything and say she was completely right. And I think the record is somewhere in between where she's right on some of this because the evidence doesn't support what they're arguing with regard to part of it. But then she's foreclosed even looking at it again. And she's made fact determinations that you're even arguing are credibility issues. So that's kind of what I'm trying to look for is what's your authority that tells us that we can just simply affirm and her fact determinations, we have to assume everything she did was correct in that regard.
I don't have any direct authority on point with that, Your Honor. I don't believe that is an issue that appellants brought up in their brief, however. And so it's my understanding that their issue is that they requested a de novo review of the second amended or of their first amended motion to arbitrate and abate. And so at that, I think this court can make the determination on de novo review whether or not it is a valid and enforceable. I think that was my understanding of the issue they presented before the court.
Without having a hearing and a record on the first amended, how are we supposed to do that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. And since she didn't do the proposed findings and conclusions of law, I would not speculate of what the Honorable Judge Fitzpatrick would be thinking on that. So I don't know any case law directly on point. I apologize.
Well, no, generally these cases, the reason why there's an interlocutory appeal with regard to these matters is because it's completely fleshed out in the trial court, so we've got a record in which we can either, affirm or deny. Or reverse, and there's a rendition usually involved in that either way. Here, because there's overlap between two separate motions and people are arguing evidence that wasn't before the court in the original hearing, but then they're being foreclosed from having the hearing that was already scheduled for the second motion, it's a little bit difficult for us from a record standpoint.
Yes, Your Honor.
One thing you can clear up for me, and you started to just a little bit, is does the record reflect that there ever was a complete contract with all four pages that is demonstrably attributable to your client?
No, Your Honor, there is not.
Okay. So the record is more of a piecemeal. Here are two that we can identify she actually signed. And then these two additional pages will have affidavit testimony or deposition testimony saying that this was what our practice was. This is what we were using at the time. This is what she would have seen, or this is what she did see. And then that's where the credibility issues come in. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. And then with the additional Ms. Downs testimony that the contract was mutually rescinded and renegotiated.
Okay. But there's nothing other than that testimony with regard to the rescission. There's no new contract that was signed that with renegotiated terms type of thing.
No, Your Honor, the appellate in this matter never proffered the updated terms and agreement. But Ms. Webster also testified that Ms. Williams-Bordeaux was given 100% refund after the execution of that contract. So there's two defendant employees who testified that there was some sort of renegotiation or new contract, whether that be oral or written, between the parties.
Is that part of what you argued in response to the original motion?
Yes, I brought it up in the original.
And presented that deposition testimony before the hearing on the original motion, or is that evidence that was brought in after the fact?
During oral arguments, I believe I brought up both Ms. Webster and Ms. Downs' testimony regarding the rescission and renegotiation with a new contract agreement. And then at that time, Judge Fitzpatrick requested the deposition transcript.
Okay. Was that something, though, that you had referenced in your response to the motion to compel? In other words, or did you just start talking about the deposition in the hearing, that it wasn't actually in your response to the motion to compel? There was no attached transcript to the response to the motion to compel, but you just started talking about it during the hearing, and in response to that, the judge kind of was a little bit worried, so she said, I need you to supplement the record with regard to that.
Yes, so my reply was on file at least 7 days before. I apologize, I don't know the exact date, but the depositions were the day before the hearing, and so I would not have the deposition transcript at that time. So I orally expressed my concerns that the November 9th, 2018 contract was not a valid enforceable contract because it was rescinded by the parties.
So basically, you're making a representation to the trial court the day after new information has been provided by sworn testimony concerning what that testimony is. It directly implicates the matter that's before the trial court at that point in time. And she recognizes that, at least to the extent of saying, I need you to give me the transcripts, okay? But basically, everybody at that point in time knew that there was new evidence that was going to implicate that particular motion that the court was taking your word for it maybe at that point in time, but said, hey, I need a record with regard to that. And then you supplemented the record at that point in time?
Yes, Your Honor. It was attached as exhibits on my reply brief that I submitted.
But then she categorically denied their ability to respond to that transcript?
They were given
you see where I'm going here is she's supposed to be ruling on a matter before her. You make a representation at the hearing, and she allows you to be able to supplement it, but she doesn't allow them to respond to it? Is that what I'm hearing?
Both parties had an opportunity to brief equally those issues.
One, you're arguing, had an opportunity to brief the issue. She gave you the opportunity to introduce new evidence and then denied them the opportunity to respond with additional evidence. That's what's wrong with this entire thing, is who's doing what, when, and where, okay? So either she's making a ruling on the record in front of her at the time, or she's allowing evidence after the fact. And what authority do you have that permits her to allow one side to supplement the evidence, but not the other side to respond?
Well, I believe that at the time of the hearing, of the first hearing on March 31st, 2022, she asked counsel if he knew there were terms and conditions. And he said, my clients haven't given it to me. I haven't seen them. And he proffered to the court. He didn't know they existed. I believe, and I can't speculate, but if he would have said, there are terms and conditions, let me go look for the pages, he would have been an opportunity. He would have given the opportunities to supplement. But that's not what applicant's counsel testified at the time. I believe he asserted, and it's in both of our briefs, that he wasn't sure if there were terms and conditions.
Okay, well, I'm not exonerating trial counsel either, because putting up an incomplete contract is probably not the best thing to do either. Okay, what I'm trying to figure out is what record we're looking at, what the rulings are, and what the record should have been with regard to that. Okay, so anything else that you...
No, Your Honor, I admit that we went kind of...
I haven't been kicked yet by Justice Womack yet. Usually I have a shock collar on, but anyway. But that's what I'm having difficulty with, is there appears to be rulings that are changing the record after the fact without allowing that record to be completed by one party as opposed to the other party, okay? But part of that was created because the party that wasn't allowed to supplement the record didn't present a complete record to begin with. And so that's what we're actually dealing with.
Yes, Your Honor. It was my understanding at the time I did ask for some sort of leave to supplement the deposition testimony. And I don't believe that applicant's trial counsel at the time asked for leave to supplement or to provide additional terms and conditions. And so when I brought it up to the trial court judge, she allowed me to provide, since it went to the heart of the issue of whether or not the November 9th, 2018 contract was the live contract between the parties.
Well, let me ask you this. Was the same trial counsel for the same opposing counsel present at the depositions the day before the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so when you're making representations about what the testimony was at the deposition, that same trial counsel, and the record will reflect that same trial counsel, had been at the deposition and therefore had an opportunity to contest your representations as to what was actually testified to?
Yes, it was the same trial attorney, Your Honor.
Okay, and they also could have asked for leave and said, well, that's not exactly what was testified to. There was some additional testimony. We would like to submit that to the court. Nothing like that occurred.
He did not request leave at any time, Your Honor.
Okay.
But he did dispute the account of the deposition that you gave to the trial court, didn't he?
Yes, I do believe that we had a discrepancy of if she actually said the word rescinded or renegotiated. And I believe the deposition transcript reflects that she said both.
Okay, so then the question becomes, under what authority did Judge Fitzpatrick decide which time she was telling the truth for purposes of denying an arbitration right, if in fact it did exist, or denying the existence of a contract, as argued by you?
I think when the trial court had the hearing, it's this argument that Appley has consistently argued throughout, is that this is a moving target for a contract. It's either 2 pages, 4 pages, it's either 2 separate entities, 1 entity, there's either 1 arbitration clause or there's 3, or this isn't even the valid contract. And so when you have these hearings, this is the first, I mean, and that's why I believe it's a question of trustworthiness, credibility-ness, and I agree with you, Your Honor, but when there is a moving target of what a contract is, and you want to supplement, and there's discrepancies between page 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, it doesn't look like it is a valid contract when your own defendant, the head manager at the defendant's facility, is saying, that's not even the contract. We renegotiated. There's another one, and they should produce it to you. It looks like, for lack of a better word, fraud on the defendant's part, that they, instead of supplementing, went and found these pages. This case has been in litigation for almost 2 years at this point. There's been extensive discovery done. The fact that they went and looked for additional terms and conditions after they were specifically asked why there are no terms and conditions. On page 1, it's clear as day that there may have been terms and conditions. It says, do not sign. Read terms and conditions. And when asked, trial counsel said, I don't know if there's terms and conditions. I've never seen any. And then they turn up. And so I think that at that point, there was a determination that once you could examine the 3rd and 4th page, that it was for a completely different company, I guess she made the determination that it wasn't credible enough to reopen when they already proffered a contract that their affiant said was true and correct, and it was only 2 pages.
All right.
How much time was there between their filing of the amended motion and getting the hearing date, and then receiving the court's order striking it?
I believe it was a month and a half, 2 months. The hearing was May 31st, and I believe we got her order on May 18th. So there was an opportunity, if they wanted to provide a response, Your Honor. And they did the amended motion 12 days after the hearing.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just a couple of rebuttal points. I want to address the unilateral rescission argument and the evidence on that point. Counsel mentioned Lorna Nicole Downs Eccles, who gave a deposition before the hearing, and we've cited this testimony in our brief. Of course, this is part of the evidence that was submitted in support of the amended motion. I want to be clear about that, but the cites are to the clerk's record, pages 408 through 411. Ms. Downs testified that she believed the contract had been reworked after execution to reflect adjusted and reduced amounts being charged to Ms. Williams. She also testified that she did not know whether a second contract was ever submitted to Ms. Williams.
Let me clarify something. So basically, both sides have quoted that part of the transcript where Judge Fitzpatrick says, I'm going to grant y'all the opportunity to get me the transcript of that deposition, okay? It's not, if I remember correctly, I can be corrected, it's not specific to one party. It's specifically, I need to see the transcript of the hearing. So they provide that after the hearing, but you also provide excerpts from the same exact deposition that was the parties were granted leave to provide excerpts from, but you do it in the form of attachments to a first amended motion. And the court strikes your first amended motion and all the evidence attached to it. Okay. That's what I need. I needed the clarification there.
And the other point, you asked counsel what was
so basically, the, effectively, she took back what the leave that she had granted both parties as to you with regard to providing excerpts from the deposition that was discussed at the hearing.
That's our position, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Were the excerpts that you attached the same material that she supplemented with?
Well, there was more. There was also, I'll correct this. I was not trial counsel, so I want to make sure I get the answer correct. But my understanding is that Ms. Franklin of SCI gave a deposition after the hearing, and she addressed in detail what the steps that she took with Ms. Williams, showing her the pages of the contract, the four pages. She went into all of that, and that can be found at the clerk's record, page 361.
But we're talking about the transcript of the deposition that took place before the hearing on the original motion that counsel referenced doing the argument in front of your trial counsel, who was at the deposition and was granted leave specifically to. There was nothing in what Judge Fitzpatrick said about, we'll supplement with the deposition that takes place after this hearing. The only supplementation that there was leave granted for was for the deposition that took place the day before, okay?
Yes.
And I'm going to re-ask his question, and she kind of conceded this point a little bit, that there was different testimony from the same witness from the day before the hearing about whether or not a contract was rescinded or not. There was different languages. There was a dispute about whether or not she used the word rescind. And so what you're telling me is that they put forward transcripts that said effectively it was rescinded, and then you added some excerpts from that particular deposition in support of your first amended motion. All of that was struck.
I want to be sure that my answer.
Let me make it simple. She says the witness said A, only presented supplemental transcript testimony that the witness said A. You attached to your motion, your amended motion, that the witness said B, and the trial court struck your transcript that the witness said B. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, but I fear that it's incomplete.
So there's a complete. So if that's your understanding, basically what you're saying is Judge Fitzpatrick made an evidentiary ruling after the fact that rescinded the leave she had granted, so that she didn't have to consider the evidence that actually she had called for at the hearing, at least as far as y'all's presentation of the excerpts.
I believe that's accurate.
Okay. All righty, counsel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The matter is submitted. We appreciate y'all's arguments. They will be very helpful. I appreciate, and I know I speak for the panel with regard to this. I appreciate the candor when I make a joke about the fact that my shock collar was not on. There's a reason for that, and that is because I sometimes ask hard questions, but sometimes I just ask some weird questions, and sometimes I'm not subject to control. So I'm about to go get chewed out here in just a minute, but that's okay. Thank y'all very, very